Welcome to the September 6th, 2017 episode of Non-Human Radio, where we talk animal rights and veganism every Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. here on KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico, or streaming online at kzfr.org. You can also find us on Facebook at Non-Human Radio. I'm Jeannie Trezino.
And I'm Danny Toms. Today we're going to talk about aquaculture, otherwise known as fish farming. Jeannie, can you tell us some fishy tales?
Sure thing. On August 19th, last month, over 300,000 farmed Atlantic salmon escaped into Puget Sound west of Bellingham, Washington, after the fish pen nets at a U.S. fish farm in the San Juan Islands broke apart and released the fish. The company, Cook Aquaculture, blamed exceptionally high tides and currents coinciding with the solar eclipse for the failure of the net pen near Cypress Island.
So not only does it affect your astrology and your mood, but apparently the solar eclipse destroys fish nets, according to Cook Aquaculture.
You know, the solar eclipse was really good for showing us our place in the world.
Yep.
I watched it and I felt really small and kind of understanding a better sense of how small we are and yet how much of an impact we have on our planet.
Wise words.
Ron Warren, Assistant Director of Fish Programs for Washington Department's Department of Fish and Wildlife, said that strong tidal flows, which are tied to lunar cycles, not the eclipse itself, could have been a factor in the damage. The weight of the fish in the pens could also have been a factor. Those 305,000 fish were estimated to weigh more than 29 million tons. However, while the tides and tidal currents in the area were, quote, fairly high and fast, end quote, they were not projected to be any stronger than they had been in May, June, or July.
So I've been resisting jumping in here because I know Jeannie's going to get to all the refutations of this silliness.
Said Greg Dusek, who is a senior scientist with the U.S. National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, in a statement that he released at the time. In another news story, Dusek was quoted as saying, quote, if all it takes is a new moon to rip it apart, perhaps having net pens of this type in the water is not a good idea, end quote.
Wow.
And that's coming from your federal government. The reason for the concern is that Atlantic salmon are not native to the Pacific waters, but they are the major aquaculture species in Washington State and British Columbia, and actually globally. If you're eating a salmon that's fish farmed, it's likely an Atlantic salmon, because they've been working on this species for decades now, making it more docile and making it much more able to have a better conversion ratio. So you feed it X amount of feed, mm-hmm. and it converts that into X amount of, like, body. And so this fish happens to be pretty good at it by this time. Their presence in fish farms and their potential to escape from net cages has been a hotly debated part of the West Coast fish farm industry for years, due to concern about whether foreign fish could cause harm to the five wild species of Pacific salmon. The concern with an introduced species like an Atlantic salmon in the Pacific Ocean is whether it could become invasive, not just present, but actually damaging to native ecology. And I'll say, you know, it could be damaging if it establishes a breeding colony, but it can also be damaging if it, passes on a virus or some kind of disease to native stocks.
I mean, we have hundreds of examples over time of this kind of species relocation wreaking havoc outside of their domain. It's kind of worrisome, actually, that they've even been doing this for so long. It just seems like a terrible idea.
Ron Warren, Assistant Director for the Fish Program for the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, who I quoted above, said that Atlantic salmon competing against wild fish for food sources, regardless of whether they're able to spawn or not, right? So these fish are out there, they're hungry, they're going to, affect that population even at that
29 million tons of fish out there looking for food.
Right.
I mean, they're competing against the natives.
They're not as robust as the natives. They're going to most likely become prey for orcas and things like that. But still, they're going to have that many fish is going to have an impact.
Sure.
University of Victoria in Canada, ecologist John Volpe said that the problem is it is unknown what the impacts are. And he went on to say that it was a dereliction of duty in terms of the regulating mechanisms in Canada to not have an answer to the question of the impacts of an Atlantic salmon release. given that the coast of British Columbia was literally awash in these potentially invasive animals.
It's like not having an evacuation plan for your skyscraper. I mean, they've been doing this for half a century.
Right.
And they're like, we don't know what's going to happen.
Right. And he's speaking for the Canadian aquaculture industry, and we have a similar issue for the U.S. Aquaculture industry. The net pen collapse pushed Washington State Governor, Governor Jay Inslee, and the Department of Natural Resources, which leases the land and sea to the Cook Company, to issue a moratorium on any new permits for fish farming in Washington State. I mean, that just goes without saying, right? It ought to. Anyway, Cook Aquaculture had planned to expand production and create more pens in the Strait of the San Juan de Fuca, but that move is now on hold because of that Washington State moratorium. And on August 31st, Washington State's Como News TV station reported that thousands of the escaped salmon have now been found up to 150 miles away. So, yeah, this is a big deal, and this has been going on. This is not the first of these pen failures, and it won't be the last.
Right.
And, you know, consumers need to be aware of this. Salmon is a very popular market fish right now.
Yeah, if you like to fish for salmon yourself and then buy salmon when you can't fish, and you need to understand the salmon you're buying is likely this farm salmon, and it's possibly destroying the salmon you like to fish.
Yeah, so.
We'll get into it in a bit here, too, about the number of parasites and diseases in these farmed fish that are now loose, and if they're commingling, are those parasites and diseases transferring?
Yeah, and then, in the course of learning a little bit about this aquaculture, you know, I mentioned about how these fish have been basically domesticated. They're more docile, and they're actually larger than they were when they first started. They're about double the size. So these are the same thing that's happened
right.
with pigs, with chickens, certainly, and to a good extent to beef cattle has also happened to fish. So, also just to note, you will probably never have the opportunity to eat a wild Atlantic salmon. If you're eating something that's labeled that, it will almost always be a farmed animal. So, yeah. And these pens are large. They are square, and they do not touch the bottom of the ocean. So they're basically suspended by a framework, a scaffolding that kind of holds them together without touching the floor bottom, but they're nets, so all the waste from the fish and such and the food that they don't eat just kind of like filters out and around. They are dragging a lot of, or releasing a lot of waste and bioparticles all over.
Right. Like so. If anyone who doesn't smoke and remembers the days of non-smoking sections in a restaurant, which was simply the invisible line next to you where the guy was smoking, but you were in the non-smoking section trying to pretend like it wasn't happening because you were across the invisible line.
Yeah, or like the smoking section at the back of an airplane.
Yeah, right.
Those were the days. Yeah, and I'll just say, just to give people a little more context too, these fish are raised actually on land in freshwater. Salmon are anadromous fish, so they spend part of their life cycle in freshwater.
Hmm.
And then when they get to a certain age, then they migrate out a stream to a river to the ocean, and then they spend a couple more years out in the ocean growing up. They have to replicate that same thing for these Atlantic salmon. So it's a relatively intensive process. They spend a year in freshwater growing to be big enough to what they call the smolt stage,
mm-hmm.
and then they are transferred to these sea pens where they grow bigger, and that can take anywhere from 16 to 24 months of feeding.
Trucking in some kind of feed to feed these animals when they're in the fresh water, and they're probably flushing that water into the river when they're done with it, et cetera, in some fashion.
Yeah, folks who are not paying attention to the water footprint of these animals, any animal agriculture, are missing a big part of the impacts of this kind of food choice, right? So, yeah, and then, of course, you know, what are these animals being fed? And it turns out in the industry, a lot of times they're being fed land plants or land animals and not so much sea animals. So their diets are radically different than they would be in the wild. So, yeah. You're listening to Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM, listener-supported community radio, hosted by Jeannie Truzzino and Danny Toms. Today we're talking about fish farming. So what's next, Danny?
I thought we'd talk a little bit more about fish farming and the toll it takes on fish. In an interview with Terry Gross on her show Fresh Air, author and scientist Jonathan Balcombe talked about fish farms and the impact that confinement has on salmon. And he found that the industry is aware of the issue and actually has a term for it. Fish who are unable to handle the confinement and filth of these aquaculture sea pens are called, quote, dropouts. That's the term they use in the fish farming industry. So what's a dropout? I mean, I know I'm a dropout, but that's a different kind. And it's a little more serious in this case for fish. Fish dropouts are when they essentially have given up on life. They become listless. They are smaller than the other fish, and they look like they have a skin condition, or possibly they have one. Some research shows that up to a quarter of the fish in any given fish farm become dropouts. Measures of their physiology suggest they're actually severely depressed. Now, I'm sure people are laughing. How can fish be depressed? Let's remember, just because they don't look like us, they're still animals, and they fit the hallmarks, both behaviorally and physiologically, of severe depression. We'll note that in a bit. Can we ask them if they're depressed? No. And one of the challenges of any study of animal feelings is that we have to surmise what is happening based on the evidence.
And you know, we don't have any trouble doing this kind of surmising with our pet dogs and cats.
Right?
I mean, we can't ask our cat, are you angry at me today? You know from their behavior.
Right?
Are you feeling ill today, you know, for your dog? And like, you know. And your dog hasn't given you a synopsis in verbal language that you can understand.
And if you weren't a dog person, you wouldn't know, and you'd have to have a dog for a while to understand those signs.
Yeah.
In a similar case for fish here. The evidence supports that they are, in fact, really miserable to the extent that they give up. They weigh about one-third of what the other fishes weigh, and it's probably because they have no control over their lives, and they are probably other aggressive fish who attack them and chase them, and they're stuck in these sea pens. It's probably terrifying. And so these fish, these dropouts, they become miserable and depressed, and they wither away. Biologist Marco Vindas of the University of Gothenburg, who published a peer-reviewed paper on this topic in 2016, was quoted as saying that, "I would not go so far as to say they are committing suicide, but physiologically speaking, they are on the edge of what they can tolerate. And since they remain in this environment, they end up dying because of their condition." The brain chemistry and behavior in the dropout fish are analogous to symptoms of depression documented in other animals, including humans. Scientists have measured significantly higher levels of cortisol, a stress response hormone, in the dropout salmon. So, you know, they're comparing these dropout salmon versus the salmon that survive, and they can see this higher level of cortisol, and you know, everybody kind of knows what cortisol does in the medical profession. Cortisol is regulated by the same system that does control serotonin levels, and they are both neurotransmitters key to the regulation of sleep, respiration, and mood. Additionally, a 2016 study discovered that 50% of all farmed salmon worldwide have deformed ear bones. This deformity, which can cut a fish's hearing ability in half, is 10 times more common in domestic farmed salmon than wild ones. So,
yeah. So, like, you know, if you were actually to be out fishing and you hooked one of these farmed salmon, you, especially one of these dropouts, you would, I don't know, I think you would think twice before whether you wanted to eat it or not.
Right. It's not going to look healthy.
Yeah.
And, you know, you think about these fish are crammed in this pen, you know, being chased by the bully fish. Half of them are deaf. I mean, it gets progressively worse and worse here, and we'll keep going. Young salmon, called smolts, often suffer from oddly curved or kinked spines, the fish equivalent of scoliosis. A host of factors have been blamed for what is called, quote, broken back syndrome, from artificial lights and unnaturally warm water used to speed up smolt growth in hatcheries to vitamin deficiencies or exposures to toxins. And finally, there are lice. Sea lice were a minor pest before the advent of large-scale, high-density salmon farms in the 1980s. Now they're one of the biggest headaches for the industry, and the methods used to control sea lice are very problematic. The, quote, thermolyser, for example, briefly immerses salmon in a tube of heated water. This burst of heat wipes out around 95% of lice, but it can also kill the salmon. I mean, just imagine if, you know, your wart removal or something was, you know, they dipped your whole body into a vat of something. In one grisly incident, thermolyser operators on a Scottish farm killed 95,000 fish. So
the capacity for creating great swaths of suffering cannot be underestimated in this industry or in any of the animal agriculture industries.
Yeah, I mean, what, you know, the first 500 or 1,000, like, where do you get before you're paying attention in this process that you're killing all the fish? Pesticide resistance and sea lice is another mounting problem, leading some farmers to dramatically up their use of these chemicals. The salmon industry in Scotland, for example, now applies almost 1,000% more delousing agents than it did just 10 years ago. Like, that's not a good metric, scaling at that rate, right? In Norway, farmers increased the use of lice-killing hydrogen peroxide by 33% in just 1 year, between 2015 and 2016.
Right, so they're definitely battling these lice, and fish are suffering, and ultimately I would say probably consumers are going to be suffering the ill effects also.
And I don't think we have the data, but I'm sure there's a correlation between the amount of fish being farmed in these individual places and the increase in lice and in the treatment of them, because they're growing their business, confining more and more animals in a small space, and running into more and more problems. Lice control chemicals can be deadly to shrimp, lobsters, and other crustaceans. They're also toxic to the salmon themselves. The same company that cooked the 95,000 fish in a thermolyser machine also poisoned an additional 60,000 fish with hydrogen peroxide. I mean, do you want your dinner meal to, you know, have little lice legs still stuck in it, essentially, or be the ones that didn't survive? But it's just disgusting.
Yeah, it's like, how much do you really need that fish?
Right.
Right? I mean, how tasty is that fish? And, you know, given this information, given the suffering attached to that fish, you know, maybe you're not ready to give it up, but you should certainly be ready to reduce.
Indeed.
Certainly ready to reduce. Yeah, and you know, and we've talked on the show before about dwindling numbers of just wild fish, right?
Right.
Schools of wild fish are decreasing globally, and numbers of farmed fish is increasing locally, but
getting harder and harder to do at scale. So
yeah.
Where does that end up?
Anyway, so so people will look to the Monterey Bay Aquarium Sustainable Seafood List, and I would say, really, the list is missing the point. Really, the point is to start changing behavior,
right?
And your choices need to be better. So, yeah, this is Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM, listener-supported community radio, and now it's. I'm going to move on to the Chico Animal Rights Calendar of Events.
All right, Chico Animal Rights Calendar of Events. All right, what do we got, Jeannie?
Sure. First, I just want to say I have a foodie tip coming up at the end of this month, September 23rd. The 106th Butte Humane Society Gala has a clearly labeled vegan option.
Woohoo!
Yeah, I mean, I think they've always had vegetarian options, mm-hmm. but this month it's like, it's labeled vegan. It's right there on a pier with the other two animal-based options. And it's a vegan shepherd's pie filled with chickpeas, mushrooms, tomatoes, lentils, bell peppers, and piped sweet potatoes.
I mean, that sounds great, right? That's not the here's your baked potato and a salad option.
Yeah.
And what's going to happen is the meat eaters there will eat the shepherd's pie, and the vegans won't get any because it looks so good.
One can hope. Anyway, I just think it's about time that there's an option not to eat animals at an event designed to rescue other animals. So
very Simpson-esque when you're doing that.
Good going, Butte Humane Society. Otherwise, what else do we have coming up? This Saturday, September 9th, from 2:30 to 7 p.m. out at Farm Sanctuary in Orland, they're having a wonderful twilight tour with presentations by Farm Sanctuary founder Gene Bauer and Susie Costin, who's like the head honcho for all the animal care there. And a cocktail hour featuring vegan cheeses, wines, and appetizers. So I think in these troubled times, the tranquil presence of the rescued animals at Farm Sanctuary are needed and welcomed. So go ahead and check them out and get your tickets online at farmsanctuary.org. And yeah, I'll see you there. I know I bought my ticket a few weeks ago. So are you going, Danny?
I'm thinking about it. I'm going to try.
Okay. Yeah, depends on the weather. It might be smoky. But
indeed.
Anyway. Also on September 23rd, same day as the Butte Humane Society Gala, if you're not going to that, come on over to the Chico Vegan Potluck from 6 to 8 p.m. Our theme is Tapas Crawl, and we'll be gathering at the Chico Library Community Room on Saturday, September 23rd from 6 to 8 p.m. And yeah, the Tapas Crawl is basically make yourself a batch of some appetizer or finger food that you can share. And you don't have to be fully vegan to go to these things. We just want you to be vegan for a couple hours. And as always, Nancy Norby Matthews of Plant Based Chica will be there hosting a table full of whole food, no salt, no oil, no sugar, good eats. And on Sunday, September 24th, we will have the Blackberry Creek Farm Animal Sanctuary Volunteer Day from 9 to 6 p.m. We had the folks from Blackberry Creek, the founders from Blackberry Creek Farm Animal Sanctuary, as guests a few weeks ago.
They were great.
Yeah, a nice couple. That's out there in Colfax, California. And there will be two volunteer shifts, one from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. and the other from 2 p.m. to 6 p.m. And they'll have a bunch of projects that you can pick to work on no matter what your ability level. So kids are welcome, 5 years and older. And they will have various things such as cleaning barns and coops, pulling weeds, trimming and rains of plants, and maybe completing some building projects for the animals there. So, yeah, check them out at Blackberry Creek Farm Animal Sanctuary on their Facebook page. They're located out there in Colfax, California. And this is their volunteer day on Sunday, September 24th from 9 to 6 p.m. And then we have on September 28th, Thursday, September 28th from 6 to 8 p.m., Plant-Based Chico will be meeting at the Chico Community Guild Hall at 2775 Nord Avenue in Chico. And they'll be having a special speaker. Local author Lonnie Muehlrath will be the guest speaker at the September 28th Plant-Based Chico meeting. She will be talking about her most two recent books, The Mindful Vegan, which just got published, The Mindful Vegan, A 30-Day Plan, and her other book, The Plant-Based Journey. So that's what I have for the calendar. And if you have an event or other news to share, go ahead and send an email to chicovegan@gmail.com and tell me all about it. And I think we're going to go to our third story.
Bonus time,
yeah. Shall I do the honors?
Why don't you do that, Jean?
All right. This is a heartwarming story about pigs, cows, and some other critters. There's nothing quite so heartwarming as a story about pigs, cows, and other critters managing to escape the slaughterhouse and living out their lives on a sanctuary, never ending up as someone's dinner. And I'm sorry, but this is not one of those stories. However, it does have a heartwarming beginning, as all these stories do. Earlier this year, firefighters from the Pewsey Fire Station in England rescued two sows and 18 of their two-week-old piglets from a burning barn on a farm. You might think that out of gratitude for the firefighters' valiant efforts, the farmer, Rachel Rivers, would have wanted to save those pigs' lives a second time by sparing them from slaughter. What you might not think is that she would offer the piglets to the firefighters as a gift in the form of sausages. Yet that's exactly what she did. And 6 months after the firefighters rescued those piglets, those same firefighters ate them at a fire station barbecue.
This seems totally normal, right?
Yeah. And then in true fashion, the firefighters even posted photos on Facebook of themselves enjoying those same sausages of the piglets that they rescued 6 months earlier. They wrote on their Facebook post, "We got to sample the fruits of our labors from that February night. Huge thank you to Rachel Rivers for dropping them off for us. Highly recommended by Pewsey Fire Station crew. And if any of our followers is having a bank holiday barbecue this weekend, then check out these sausages. They are fantastic." Talk about cognitive dissonance,
yeah.
Huh? It didn't take long for outrage to grow over those photos and tweets.
Shockingly.
As you can imagine.
Yeah.
Many of the comments on social media defending the barbecue say the firefighters knew the piglets were being raised for meat when they rescued them, so what was the big deal, right? I mean, of course. What was the difference, some asked, between eating these piglets or sausages bought at the store? And of course, right, the issue here is that it's just immoral to want to eat a creature whose life you personally saved, I think. And to the firefighters' credit, in response to so many people taking umbrage on social media, they issued an apology on the Pewsey Fire Station Facebook page saying, quote, "We recognize that this has caused offense to some, and we apologize for this, and as such have removed the post." So it's an apology, but not really an apology. And it didn't matter. It's not the apology to the to the animals who it matters to, right? Rivers, the farmer, said she did feel sad about the fate of the piglets, but it's how she makes a living, saying, "This is just what we do. We are not an animal sanctuary. We give the pigs the best opportunity and the best life that they could have for 6 months."
I mean, they kill pigs every day, right? What difference does it make to them?
Yeah. Anyway, and so, you know, if you do a quick Google search, there are actually quite a few animal sanctuaries in England that could have been happy to take those piglets, right?
Right.
A crowdfunding campaign could have easily raised more than enough money to cover the cost of, you know, buying the piglets and relocating them, but it's too late now. And I don't know, that just stuck with me, just the idea that these firefighters would then eat a whole bunch of animals that they had rescued just 6 months earlier.
Sometimes Jeannie digs up the stories that I intentionally skipped on Facebook because they make me too upset.
Anyway. So that leads us to one last piece of business to take care of, and that's the animal rights quote of the week. Take it away, Danny.
Today's animal rights quote of the week is from Gustav Soderfeldt, who was a small-scale, quote, humane farmer back in 2006 in Sweden. Farming grew out of his involvement with and passion for the whole back to the land, grow your own sustainable food movement that is probably resonating with many of our listeners. Soderfeldt raised free-range pigs, sheep, goats, chickens, and even opened a shop in Sweden for local organic foods that sold meat and vegetables from his farm as well as from others nearby. He was the embodiment of locavorism and the so-called sustainable regional food.
Yeah, I imagine a number of farmers here in Chico know, would like look up to this guy and think he was a hero.
Right. But while running the shop, his ideas around and options for, quote, ethical meat began to crumble. He soon realized that because producing meat is as unnecessary as it is violent, ethical, humane meat was an impossibility whenever and wherever it was possible to grow plentiful plant-based foods. Soderfeldt went on to say, quote, "When I began to learn more about veganism, I realized vegans had the same basic idea as I did. Vegans cared about animals and wanted to do right by them. But vegans were more logically and morally rigorous and accountable than I was. They took that idea to its logical conclusion, which is, if you care about animals, you shouldn't exploit them at all." And that's my main beef with that industry is that, well, we exploit less and then we kill them nicely. Exploitation's exploitation. So, Non-Human Radio is made possible through the generous contributions of KZFR listeners like you. Many thanks to Sue Hildebrand for her engineering assistance and immoral and moral support. Stay tuned for Sue's show, The Real Issue, coming up next. Sue and her guests will be talking about the last efforts to reform healthcare, including whether repeal and replace is still possible. And in the second half of her show, Sue and her guests will be discussing the legality of DACA as an executive order. I would stay tuned for this one.
This has been Non-Human Radio, a production of KZFR 90.1 FM, Chico. The views and opinions expressed on this broadcast are those of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of KZFR, its board, its volunteers, or its staff. But you know what? I bet it represents the opinions and thoughts of their pets, their companion animals.
That's right, Jeannie. That is right. Our theme music is Ready to Fall by vegan activist Rockers Rise Against. If you missed any portion of this show or you want to listen again, go to the archives at kzfr.org. This is Danny Toms and Jeannie Trezino signing off. Until next week, be different, be better, be kind,
and go vegan.
Every action is a reaction. We've got one planet and one chance.